Hello and welcome to Minor Recs. I'm Charlie, and today I'm joined by Angelo, Ariana, and Quinn, and we'll be talking about the 96th Academy Awards, the upcoming Oscars. We'll be talking about our picks for the Best Picture, the big categories, and some of the snubs that the Academy may have forgotten about. So, Angela, what is on the docket this year?
So I thought we'd just go right into it and discuss what our Best Picture choice is.
Okay.
The 10 movies listed for Best Pictures are American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. My personal pick for Best Picture this year is going to be Killers of the Flower Moon by Martin Scorsese.
Okay.
It is, it's 3.5 hours long, but it's the fastest 3.5 hours of your life. As soon as the movie started, I was so into it. It was quite depressing, but also just like so enthralling. Yeah.
I've seen a few of these. I haven't seen the big ones that have been winning the majority of the awards. I haven't seen Oppenheimer, and I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, which I think Oppenheimer is probably going to win, but I have seen American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, Past Lives, and The Zone of Interest. And based on my opinion of what film should win of the ones that I've seen, I'd probably say Zone of Interest or Anatomy of a Fall, even though I also really liked American Fiction.
Similarly, I've not seen all of these, and I haven't seen Killers of the Flower Moon, so that... I liked the book, which I read a number of years ago, but I've not seen the film. The ones I have seen are Barbie, Oppenheimer, and Poor Things. And if I had to pick based purely off enjoyment, I think that the spectacle of Oppenheimer and the set and design of Barbie are both really great, but I enjoyed Poor Things the most. I thought Emma Stone was great. I thought the costume design, the set design were very interesting. And it was like a different story. I think we talked about before we started recording Everything Everywhere All at Once winning last year, and how that was kind of a different movie. And Poor Things hit that same button for me. So that would be my pick.
I'll totally agree with you. I think I said last year that Everything Everywhere All at Once is the sort of movie that I'm always hoping for when I go to the movie theater, something that's going to change genres every couple minutes and, you know, just keep you enthralled and guessing and imagining what could happen next. And Poor Things is definitely in that realm of very original filmmaking. And I'm very glad to see the Academy is recognizing that again. I don't think it is going to win. I think probably Killers of the Flower Moon or Oppenheimer is more likely, a more typical Oscar movie. But if I was voting, then Poor Things would also be my pick.
Yeah.
Well, in addition to Best Picture, I also wanted to discuss Best Actor and Best Actress. Mm. The five picks for Best Actor are Bradley Cooper in Maestro, Colman Domingo from Rustin, Paul Giamatti from The Holdovers, Cillian Murphy from Oppenheimer, and Jeffrey Wright from American Fiction. I haven't seen any of the movies listed outside of Oppenheimer on this one, but Cillian Murphy did a fantastic job in that role. I read the book that Oppenheimer was influenced by, American Prometheus, which I also think Oppenheimer should win Best Screenplay Adaptation because there's just like whole passages from the book that were taken as dialogue, but in the book it was just the author explaining what was happening. But Cillian Murphy just like absolutely captured how I pictured Oppenheimer reading American Prometheus. Yeah. So, did anyone else have any thoughts on Best Actor?
The only film I've seen from the nominations would be American Fiction with Jeffrey Wright, and I thought he did a great performance. I could see him winning. I just don't know if that film. I feel like a lot of times comedies don't win, and I'm not sure why. It could be one of those things kind of similar where that's just a genre that they don't. I feel like dramatic roles are a lot more kind of put up on a pedestal, and I remember like when Get Out was nominated, and that's a horror, and American Fiction, it is a drama, but I would call it more of like a dramedy. And his performance is very comedic, but it's so much more nuanced, and there's like so much that's said almost, I think he's a fantastic actor as well.
Yeah, if you guys have ever
seen, if you've seen him in any of the stuff that he's done, he's so good. And in this, he was fantastic too. And I've never seen him in a comedic role, and he did it in a way that was very real and also heart wrenching. And I love that film. I loved him in it. It would be wonderful if he won and American Fiction got more recognition. The fact that it's even on this list is wonderful because I enjoyed it the whole way through.
I'm in the same boat as Angelo for the leading role. I only saw Oppenheimer of those movies. I really wanted to see American Fiction, but the only theater it was playing in when I could see it was like 20 miles away.
Probably the one I went to.
Yeah. Yeah, the perils of living in the suburbs. But I thought Cillian Murphy did a great job. Yeah, it is Cillian. He's an Irishman. Yeah, I thought he killed it. I think everyone, Robert Downey Jr. is also my pick for Best Supporting Actor. I thought he was great in it. I hope he gets more roles after coming off of Marvel hot and then doing Doolittle. Was a terrible career choice. So I thought both of them were great in it. I would be happy with the sweep from Oppenheimer in those categories. I wanted to also see The Holdovers. I heard really good things about Paul Giamatti's performance in that, but yeah, due to only having seen Oppenheimer, I will have to go with Cillian Murphy.
The Holdovers, was that a comedy as well?
It's a comedy. Like,
yeah.
There's a surprising number of comedies. I think you could also call Poor Things a comedy to an extent.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very dark comedy.
Yeah. One of my friends said for her, she saw Poor Things, and she said there was too much whimsy for her for Poor Things. But as far as The Holdovers go, which I haven't seen, but my stepbrother saw it 5 times within 2 months. He really liked it. Yeah. But he's also a big-time movie guy, so I think that's not typical.
One thing I wanted to mention with this category is that I'm already going to snubs, but I think that Leonardo DiCaprio should have been nominated for this category for his performance in Killers of the Flower Moon. Killers of the Flower Moon, he basically plays the villain, but it's like he's like I never see Leonardo DiCaprio in a role where he's kind of pathetic and like not intelligent and not cool. And he really captured this, like, he's like a combination of, I don't want to say gangster, criminal, but he's like bad at being a criminal. Yeah. So.
Yeah, kind of bumbling is not adjective for most of Leo's roles. Mm. But I would dare say he's probably got enough awards. I think he'll be just fine.
Then there is the Best Actress category, and the 5 picks for that are Annette Bening for Naiad, Lily Gladstone for Killers of the Flower Moon, Sandra Hüller for Anatomy of a Fall, Carey Mulligan for Maestro, and Emma Stone for Poor Things. I wouldn't be surprised if we're all in agreement that I believe Emma Stone should win for this category.
Agreed.
Agreed, yeah.
Poor Things is basically about she is resurrected with the brain of a newborn baby, essentially. So she's kind of this Frankenstein monster. She has an adult body, but she has the mind of a child. And she progresses through the movie learning. You see that progression, like, perfectly. How she, like, can't even say a full sentence in the very beginning of the movie, and then by the end, you know.
Yeah, it is a very impressive performance, technically. And also, like, she's on the screen for 90% of the film.
Yeah,
it's a lot of work.
Yeah, I thought she did a great job. She killed it. I also just like Emma Stone in general. She's been great in most of the stuff that I've seen her in. I will say, for the people that have seen Killers of the Flower Moon, the Times pegged Lily Gladstone to win. What do you think about that?
Like, she did good in that role. Just she wasn't as memorable as the villains to me, I guess.
Mm.
To me, I came out of that movie remembering Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio's characters way more. Yeah,
I think that is also with Barbie. Well, supporting actress America Ferrera has been nominated, but Margot Robbie was snubbed for.
I thought that was very surprising.
Yeah, because again, like, she delivered the much more memorable performance and is on screen for the entire movie, essentially. Yeah. I think there's maybe a couple of scenes with just Ken. But yeah, I thought that was surprising to me in this category that Margot Robbie wasn't recognized.
From stuff I've read, they were saying a lot. It was like that big speech that America Ferrera gave in Barbie that kind of sealed the deal for her nomination.
Yeah. And it's a very memorable part of the movie, and it's sort of like the thesis statement of the movie. But it isn't very much of the movie. It's like only like 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And for the rest of the movie, she's kind of a background player. Like, I enjoy the character, but it is very strange that she was nominated and Margot Robbie wasn't.
Mm-hmm. That happens a lot, though, because I even think about with Les Mis, how Anne Hathaway had won, and she was hardly in. I mean, she did a great performance, but she was hardly in that film. Or I just think about some of the other supporting actresses that have been nominated, or supporting actors, and their role was not as memorable as some of the others. But that being said, yeah, I am surprised about America Ferrera being nominated and then not Margot Robbie.
Yeah.
Although I think it may speak to the aforementioned Oscar voter bias against comedies, because it does seem like in the big categories, comedies usually do get shut out, and sometimes in the supporting actor, actress, you'll see some of the comedy roles. And I was very glad to see Mark Ruffalo's role in Poor Things get a nod. He's a womanizing cad named Duncan Wedderburn, which is it's almost a cartoon character, but it's very entertaining.
Yeah.
Everyone's a cartoon character in that movie, especially William Dafoe.
And, of course, Ryan Gosling. It's also very cool to see him get recognized for his role in Ken. But as with the song getting a nod for Best Original Song, it seems like the Oscar voters kind of missed the point of Barbie by not nominating the most impressive women involved in it, like Greta Gerwig. Yeah. I'm sure we'll get to the director category, but how was she not nominated?
Yeah, I'm really surprised about that, because she basically made that film come to life, and it's been one of the most hyped films, and everyone saw it. And
like, technically, she's kind of like an auteur. Like, she writes and directs and does a lot of the design and whatnot. But I think she is nominated. She and Noah Baumbach are nominated for Best Screenplay. But certainly, the direction of that movie is a large part of the appeal, just the pop of color and the forward motion of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a huge snub.
Yeah.
It is just a very loaded year.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of impressive. It's probably one of the best years ever, honestly, in terms of what's nominated. Just going back over the Best Actress category to see who I would get rid of in favor for Margot Robbie. Mm. I mean, it's really difficult. I forgot that Sandra Hohler was one of the Best Actress nominees for her role as Sandra in Anatomy of a Fall. Anatomy of a Fall is this like French legal drama where she basically plays the wife in this possible murder mystery crime. And it's basically a character drama where, as you said, kind of with Margot Robbie, she's like in 90% of the movie. Yeah.
Sounds very noir.
The camera's like very on her.
Okay.
She would be easily my second choice if not for Emma Stone.
Okay.
Yeah, I thought she was, because I haven't seen Poor Things, but I saw both Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest, which Sandra Hohler was in both.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, she was the lead female role for both of them. And her role in Zone of Interest, I was a little bit surprised that's not nominated. I think that's a little bit more one note because she's playing the wife of an affluent family, a commander in the Nazi army. And so that was a little bit more one note. But with Anatomy of a Fall, I think she plays it very well, and it's kind of like a whodunit, and the fact that we still don't know by the end of it, and we don't know if we can believe her or not, speaks to how she acted it. And so having saw that, I thought she played it really well. And also, I always say, like, my favorite movies are movies where nothing happens and it's all character development, and this was my year as far as movies go.
This is probably your most, of the movies I saw this year, the most, like, typical Oscar movie, I feel. Mm-hmm. I recommend it. It's not really close to my, like, Best Picture nominee, but there was a lot of times where I was just kind of captivated by the plots. The first 30 minutes feel like a police procedural before going into the legal drama. And I just wanted to know, where would you rank it, Ariana? Cause you
of the ones I've seen?
Yeah. Anatomy of a Fall.
It was up there. I think it would probably have been, I think it was my favorite. It's hard because I think I like categorize things of like what I liked best, but then also what I think is typical of Oscar movies in the past. So to me, I think that's funny that you say it's a typical Oscar movie because I don't think it is, because I think a lot of it is almost kind of like a crime drama, but nothing that much happens. And I feel like usually Oscar movies are a little bit more action-packed. But I loved it. I think essentially it is like a whodunit, like crime drama, and she's in the majority of it. But it is kind of like modern day France that's happening, and what they bring into it, and the question. It's basically you're in the courtroom almost the whole time. Well, that's the majority of it.
I was getting flashbacks to a Gone Girl watching it.
Okay.
Because one of the themes that Gone Girl touches on is like what happens to like a person when they're like the center of like a media circus. Like this is kind of a crime of the century drama. And this person has to do things like, even though she's probably innocent, she has to like lie about certain things and like put on like a character in order to convince people that she's innocent. Yeah.
Okay.
Also, the French legal system seems to work way different than the United States.
That was interesting to see, like, even just their costumes.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were wearing these big robes, which I think they still do. Mm. And so I remember I was watching it. I ended up looking it up on my phone to be like, oh, is this what they still wear in the court system? And it is. Like, the lawyers dress up in these, like, big robes that almost look like royalty and king-esque. And
do they have powdered wigs? And
no powdered wigs, but they probably just got rid of
the
that.
The English still do that.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, because even though it was like a French film, but it was supposed to have taken place in like three different languages because it was German, French, and then English. Yeah. But it wasn't one of the foreign film nominations, correct?
No, it wasn't, yeah. I think it's just because it does use quite a lot of English. Plus, the way that the international category works is that the country itself nominates.
Okay.
France probably just chose something else. Yeah.
Yeah. And then if you guys end up seeing it or any of our listeners, let us know if you think she did it or not. Because I'm always curious. Everyone who I've talked to who has seen it, they'd be like, oh, do you think she did it or not? And then we talk about that.
Oh, boy. An ambivalent ending.
Sign oh, yeah. I know. The best. Where you don't really know what happened. What did you think of the little boy actor?
So everyone's acting was amazing. Mm-hmm. The best performance is from the dog. I don't really want to describe that scene too much because it does happen later in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I asked myself while watching, like, oh my God, how did they make the dog do that? Like,
the dog did evoke dog the most emotion out of me from that film.
It was insane watching, yeah. Because I thought it was.
Why is he not nominated?
Is it a big dog, small dog?
Medium size. Medium dog. Yeah. Another movie that Ariana and I watched was Past Lives, another multilingual one, English and Korean. We're actually doing this next month as a foreign film talk. This is another one that's nominated for Best Picture, but also it is nominated for Best Original Screenplay. Yeah.
The director, I think she's a producer of it too. The director, she is kind of based on her life. So an immigrant from Korea who moves to Canada and then eventually to New York to become, I think it's a writer, someone who does like screenplays, and clearly that worked out for her. But in the film, it's interesting because it opens up and you see this woman and then two men kind of sitting down, one also from Korea and the other one American, and there's like outsider characters kind of commenting on, oh, what do you think is going on? Are they dating? Or are they just friends? This or that. But essentially, the movie is about two childhood friends who liked each other when they were younger and reconnecting 33, 32 years in the future, and what that means, and having that bilingual and cultural difference. And I loved it. I thought it was so well acted. And I could see the screen. I mean, it reminded me a lot of the story of One Day, where kind of this couple reconnects every few years just for one day and rekindle their past. It's similar but different. But I really liked it.
Okay. I was surprised that it wasn't nominated for Best Cinematography. I think it's probably the most, out of all the nominees, the most beautiful to look at. The director uses the locations really well. There's scenes when they're like children still playing in like a South Korean park. And she just uses, like, the statues there really good for, like, framing the shots.
Even some of the scenes where it wasn't so noticeable or recognizable were interesting, too. There's this one scene when they're kids, and the main character, she's walking up the stairs, and then the guy is walking down the stairs, and you kind of have them, like, right next to each other. And then I think they brought that scene back in another way, and I remember thinking, like, oh, this is really neat. And I remember, like, watching an interview or something where they had to walk kind of slowly to make that happen. I agree. I think it was really thought out for the cinematography.
Yeah, yeah. I can't believe that wasn't nominated and Oppenheimer was, because I actually found the cinematography and editing in particular of Oppenheimer nauseating at times. The first 30 minutes of Oppenheimer, it feels like it's like a commercial being filmed. Yeah, it's like cut, yeah. Mm-hmm. Once the movie like slows down, unless you actually take in the scene, then it becomes like really fantastic, yeah.
From what I've heard of the people who I talked to who saw Oppenheimer, they said that you have to be interested in the subject to really like it. Do you guys think that's true?
I think to an extent. I think the performances are great. I think it is slow, and the payoff kind of happens like, you know, it's difficult to say because Oppenheimer leaves you in like now where it goes, the atomic bomb is here, the geopolitical landscape that we exist in is different, and it kind of leaves you to sit with that, how it relates to like your place in society now and the modern geopolitics of what we have going on. So I think like it's like a think piece hidden within a biopic to an extent, because that's what I was thinking about the whole time. I mentioned before this, I had, like, my great-grandfather was the head accountant on the Manhattan Project, so he was like pretty involved, and we have records of his, you know, resignation after they dropped the bomb. He didn't know it was a weapon, or he didn't know it was the atomic bomb. He knew it was a weapon. And so we have all of these like familial artifacts. And so for that reason, I was like very interested in the subject, especially a lot of the times they're coming to Chicago and they mentioned like Oak Ridge where he was a little bit. So I had like a personal stake in it, and that's what kept me interested for a lot of it. But I think you could enjoy it without being like particularly interested. It may just be a little drier if thinking about the larger societal impacts the creation of the atomic bomb had isn't something that, you know, particularly tickles you. But I enjoyed it. I don't think it should win Best Picture, but I enjoy it. Because Oppenheimer, they kind of leave it where he is, like, remorseful and whatnot, and then they don't. I have a lot of bones to pick with that movie. But like, they don't. They show a little bit of, like, his ideation of, like, the damage it's causing in Japan to people, and sort of, like, they kind of suggest, like, him and Einstein talking about, like, oh, man, we are screwed. Like, what did we do? Someone was going to do it. But they don't, like, talk about the land that they use for testing is still irradiated to this day and is, like, very difficult to live on. They relocated thousands of indigenous people, I want to say, to film there. People that lived in the area directly post-World War II had a lot of issues with, like, cancer and birth defects that still linger in those communities to this day. So I feel like they kind of glossed over that larger impact, and that is forgiven in the fact that it is a biopic about J. Robert Oppenheimer. It's about his life first and foremost, and not so much like the surrounding context. But then they acknowledge the context a little bit, and then it's just kind of like, oh, it makes him feel bad or whatever. But it's like, this is the world that everyone has to live in now, and this shaped, you know, the way that like human geography is to this day, and still is a factor in a lot of like geopolitical movements.
For a lot of the reasons that you said, like, Oppenheimer should probably not win. Killers of the Flower Moon did like the reverse of that, where the book is really more about the foundation of the FBI than the movie is. Mm-hmm. But Martin Scorsese really wanted it to be a focus on the Osage tribe who was affected by this horrible crime. And he even employed real Osage Native Americans to be actors in the movie. I think that's part of the reason he should definitely win Best Director.
From what I've heard about that film, though, is that it was still kind of from the white man's perspective, though, that he didn't necessarily take it far enough, or that he had kind of turned the book narration to the cop and to the white man.
Yeah, it's definitely feels more like a villain narrative than it is about the Osage. But like, from my perspective, the Osage didn't realize that they were characters in this movie, basically. Martin Scorsese also does come from a background where he does direct like crime fiction predominantly. Kind of gave me Goodfellas flashbacks in a way. Yeah, I think it was definitely an even amount of the white villains and the Osage tribe. Yeah,
that's good to hear. I do want to see it. It's just 3 hours or 3.5 hours is a big commitment. I've heard from my boyfriend's family, they're Ojibwe, and so his mom and her brother went to go see it just because they have a lot of connection to their Native American roots, and so it was important to them. And they said maybe there should have been an intermission.
I wasn't on streaming, so I did pause it for intermission, actually.
So you did take an intermission?
Yeah, I was going to watch it, and then one person I was planning to watch it with had work in the morning, and it was 8 o'clock. So they had never seen Parasite, so we just watched Parasite again.
I was scared about Zone of Interest being super long, because I had thought it was 3 hours. It wasn't. I think it was just a little bit more than an hour and a half, or like just a little bit less than 2 hours. Mm. Because that's another one, it kind of reminds, I mean, not having seen Killers of the Flower Moon, but I think it was very hard to watch, especially, like, my family grew up Jewish and stuff like that. So, like, Zone of Interest was interesting in the way where it follows this affluent family who, the husband in it, he's a commander, a high-up commander for Auschwitz, and they live literally right on the other side of the fence of Auschwitz, so you're watching everything that they do, and it's all kind of surrounded around them being in this house, but you hear and see everything going on from the background, so you don't actually see anything happening in the camp at all. Like, you see, like, at night when it gets dark, you see the smoke from Auschwitz, and you see, like, the fire coming out of the chimney, and then you hear the yelling of the guards and the shooting, and you see them, like, holding up a handkerchief to their mouth, and it's basically about complacency and how you just kind of let that go by. But I felt like it was just like very hard to just hear it constantly. And there were moments where I did cry, but I cry for almost. So to be fair, I cry for almost every movie. I think I cried for Past Lives. Like, I cried for everything. I cried for American Fiction just because I liked it. So I will cry for almost every movie. Like, I cried for many a movie that other people have not cried for. But I did cry numerous times for that one just because it was very hard for me to handle.
I wanted to mention that. I saw recently Steven Spielberg said that was the best Holocaust film since Schindler's List. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should win the Oscar, personally. Like, of the movies I've seen, I think that would be my topic for winning the Oscar just because of the way it was filmed and the sound and how much it meant. But I want to say I loved it, but I also wouldn't recommend it, and I also don't want to say I loved it, but I recommend it.
Right.
Considering that it's like a historical drama, I'm surprised it's not listed as like in the best production design or best costume design category, because part of the reason I liked Oppenheimer and Killer so much was because I really did like feel like going back in time, yeah.
I wonder if it's just because it's so centered on, I mean, there's very few characters really in it because it's really just centered on this one family and they're kind of just wearing everyday German clothing. So you don't see, you see like some of the outfits from the guards and you really don't see a ton of it. And I wonder, and it wasn't necessarily about that. And I think that's probably why it wasn't nominated for that.
Okay. Going back to best production and costume design for a second, I did have Oppenheimer as winning both those categories.
Okay.
Until last night at midnight on the dot, Poor Things was put up to streaming.
So you watched it last night at midnight?
Yeah. In preparation for this podcast.
It's very fresh.
It is very fresh. And that is currently my pick for both those categories, best production and best costume. Mm-hmm. How would you feel about that?
I thought it was great. I agree. It should win. I was talking to you about this before we started recording, that I was reading an article where when you're watching Poor Things, the sets kind of feel like dreamlike and kind of like stage sets initially, because her world is very narrow and she has a childlike conception of the world around her. And then as the movie continues and she like grows and her perception matures, the like sets and everything around her become more realistic. And then clothing around her also does, but her clothing stays very whimsical and kind of like this, I don't know, dreamlike interpretation of Victorian or directly post-Victorian era London. So I think they really employ like the set and costume to drive home the messaging of the film and support Emma Stone's character's development. So that's why I think it should win.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. And I would also just add cinematography onto that. I think the cinematographer of Poor Things, Robbie Ryan, should also be singled out for, as you say, just for how seamlessly the very bold choices that he makes affect how you take in the film. Like when she's very young, it's sort of like a grainy black and white film. As she grows up, then it's sort of almost surreally smooth, like digital art. It goes through a lot of different looks of film, and I thought that was a very subtle way of taking you out of reality and into the world of that movie.
It's kind of almost difficult to explain what the movie looks like.
Yeah.
Like, aesthetically, the closest I can think of is, like, Tim Burton-esque, I guess. But mixed with, like, if you know the director Alejandro Jodorowsky, he's a Chilean filmmaker who all his movies feel like...
psychedelic trips.
Acid trips.
Yeah.
But also, I was also imagining The Fifth Element is another one. That French science fiction film. Yeah. And the movie is like science fiction. It is like a steampunk almost Victorian
because,
era.
Yeah, you do say that it's sort of Victorian, but there's also kind of futuristic elements of it as well. Kind of.
We're first introduced to William Dafoe's character, who you mentioned Mark Ruffalo as a pick. And he definitely is probably, like, besides Emma Stone, the best actor from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely want to discount William Dafoe in this role.
Yeah.
He plays like a mad scientist, but like... Whereas in, like, our reality, he would be, like, isolated, like, sent off to an island because he's making these, like, combining animals, like, giving dogs duck heads and stuff like that, basically making Frankenstein monsters. And in the reality of this movie, he's, like, held up as this amazing doctor.
Right.
Yeah, he's, like, the most respected surgeon in the world.
Even though his visual appearance does sort of make him a grotesque figure.
Yeah. I really enjoyed how they did his characterization. He, like, begins the movie as sort of a villain or at least an abusive parental figure, and then they kind of, like, onion layer his character in anecdotes that he has from his childhood that, like, humanize him and reveal his, like, larger motivations. And then by the end of the movie, I really ended up liking his character, and I thought they did a great job in sort of portraying parental relationships in general. Like, your parents are always going to give you trauma, and you're always going to love them despite that if they're a good parent. And the reconciliation that they have by the end of that movie is great. I really enjoyed it.
Would you recommend that movie to people then?
Adults, yes.
So, okay.
It's very gratuitous.
Because I think about, we kind of talked about this, I think all three of you agree that it was a strange... You wouldn't have expected a movie like this to be on the list of best pictures and to have gotten so much hype. And he was also the director of The Lobster, which have we all seen The Lobster?
I haven't seen The Lobster, but I did see his other movie, The Favorite.
I also saw The Favorite. Yeah. That was a strange one to have been nominated to, which I did like that. I also really liked The Lobster, but the people who I went with after we left said, "How dare you choose this film?" So they did not, and they were not happy that I even... took them there.
Do not watch any of his movies, Yorgos Lanthimos, with your parents. It's going to make for a very awkward movie night.
I'm told that the director, Yorgos Lanthimos, is part of a movement called the Greek Weird Wave, which is very appropriate because his movies are very original and absurdist and surreal and weird, very weird. And I'm here for it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I saw The Lobster when I was still in high school, and I just... totally went over my head, and I was like, what was that? That was so weird. It's like, because it had like Colin Farrell and John C. Reilly in it, and I like both of those performers, and I was like, I don't get what this movie is trying to get at, but, you know, upon reflection, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah.
All of his movies feel like they were written by an alien who, like, doesn't understand, like, human dialogue, especially The Lobster.
Yeah.
I want to plug in Canopy again, because almost all of his movies are on Canopy outside of Poor Things.
Oh, great.
So in addition to The Lobster, there's Dogtooth and Killing of a Sacred Deer.
Yeah. Okay. I'll have a big weird movie marathon.
I'm only allowed to do those alone.
Now, Ariana, another movie you saw that we did not see was American Fiction. I wanted to ask you a little about that. Just what was the general synopsis of that? Because I have no idea.
So it's actually based on a book called Erasure, which I have not read, but it's basically about this serious writer who has never gotten the publicity that he feels that he deserves. And he was at this conference, and one of the authors there who is in this film, she's really hyped up. Everyone has read her book, and they love it. And she writes it from like a stereotypical African American narrator. And he's like, I can write that. I can do that. And he almost kind of gets mad and he writes this book as a satire. And people love it. It's getting picked up by major publishing companies and they want him on TV. And his original title, like, could you have something a little bit more gritty or something a little bit more stereotypical? And so he's doing this as this joke, but people love it. And it almost kind of turns, he discusses it and he ends up, like, I don't want to give too much away, but I think it makes him think about our pre-judgment towards things. Like he's been raised in this way and he's almost kind of pushing against it and he doesn't want to be part of this community that could be supporting him and there's much more to it and it's much more nuanced. So while all this is going on, he's returning home to deal with his mother who has Alzheimer's and his sister comes home and one of his brothers is going through it. So it's talking about his personal life and then he's living this second life of writing this satire that he won't put his real name on and It's fantastic. It's so funny, and it really, as a white person, I think a lot of times, like, it holds up a mirror to us, so there's that. But I think it also is holding up a mirror to maybe the more, like, left side of, like, African-Americans, too, or, like, people, like, you know what I mean? It's just, like, it's just very much, you can see yourself in it. It feels very reflective, and it's so funny, and it's so heartwarming. And we didn't talk about Sterling K. Brown, who's up for a supporting role, and he won it, I think, for the Golden Globes, and I really think he could win it. He plays Jeffrey Wright's brother, who is going through a divorce because it's found out that he is gay. And because you see him going through it in his own personal life, but then also with what's going on with their own mother. And then, and this isn't even reflected in his own, in Jeffrey Wright's character writing the book and his professional element of it. And it's just, it's very funny. It's very insightful. I recommend everyone to watch it because I didn't even know about it. We usually try to watch a film together as a family, usually around Christmas time, and that was the one that they had chosen. And when I looked up the preview, I was like, oh, yeah, let's see this. So I recommend it to everyone. It's great.
Cool. There were a few categories that we haven't really talked about yet because they're just more specific than Best Picture. Stuff like Best Animated Movie, Best Visual Effects. Did anyone want to talk about a movie that they haven't really mentioned yet?
Yeah, so I have a couple from Best Animated Film. The Boy and the Heron is Hayao Miyazaki's latest Studio Ghibli movie. I went to go see it. I thought it was beautifully animated. I really enjoyed it. I went to go see it thinking it was going to be the English dub, and it was the Japanese audio version. So they had subtitles. So I looked away a couple times and was immensely confused for large portions of the movie because it is a confusing. The story takes place during the war in Japan, and you follow a boy whose mother dies in a bombing when he is probably like 11 or 12, I want to say. That's typically the age of Miyazaki protagonists. So his father, who appears to be some sort of manufacturing, he owns a manufacturing company. He does wartime manufacturing for the Japanese military, marries his mom's sister, so the boy's aunt becomes his mother, and also she looks a lot like his mom. So I missed the part when they were like, this is his aunt, and now it's his mother. And then they're talking about how much she looks like his mother and also referencing her as the aunt and his mother. So I was, like, very confused for 20 minutes until because I looked away. I looked down to, like, grab popcorn or something. And then so the boy gets moved to her family's, his new mother slash aunt, her family's estate in the countryside where the father is also doing, like, manufacturing. And there is, like, this, like, magical realism that is probably, like, the first hour of the movie, and then it goes totally like Spirited Away style, like stepping over the threshold into like a magical, fey, wild type world. So it kind of drags a little bit up until that point. And then once you get there, it's really just off to the races. So I really enjoyed it. I would recommend it. I do want to see the English dub because the actors in it are like Christian Bale, Willem Dafoe. There's a bunch of other...
Isn't Robert Pattinson?
Yeah, Robert Pattinson is in it. And he plays, based on the Japanese audio, not who I expected him to play. He plays a character that kind of talks like, like that kind of, if you watch a lot of media that has Japanese audio, you know the voice archetype I'm talking about. So you wouldn't expect Robert Pattinson to voice that person. I recommend it, especially if you're a Studio Ghibli fan. It's kind of like a love letter from Miyazaki to the fans. And I don't know if you would, I still consider Spirited Away probably his magnum opus, but this is probably the most like personal to him in retrospect of his career. And yeah, it can be a little bit confusing at times, but it's worth the ride. I also saw Nimona, which was kind of, yeah, sure, it's pretty good. It's good. It's a kid's movie.
It's based on a graphic novel that's like,
that makes
I'd say YA.
Yeah.
We put it a lot in our teen book boxes.
Yeah, I would definitely call it YA. It's about a girl. She's an outcast. She turns into a monster. She lives in a society that has legends about how dangerous the monster is. So she's like an outcast and kind of a punk kid. And then there's a knight, and he gets outcast for a murder that he's framed for, and they kind of team up. And it's fun if you got kids, especially kids, I would say, in the range of like 6 to 12. I think it's like a good film to watch with them because it's still entertaining despite the demographic that it's going for as an adult. And then the third one that I've seen that is nominated, which is the one that I think should win, is the second Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse movie. Great. Again, if you've seen the first, you know, like the animation quality is there. The voice acting is great. The cinematography, the way that they like frame shots is very interesting, very dynamic. It's much more a story about Gwen Stacy's character in this one. And I thought they did a wonderful job going into her backstory, exploring her relationship with her father, who is the chief of police in New York. I thought it was great. The one gripe I would have is that it definitely feels like a part one. There is a part two coming out. It was supposed to come out this March, but I was like, no way they are doing that. The articles I read about the Lord Miller, so like Phil Lord Christopher Miller, who also did the Lego movie, I believe. The way that they process animation and produce it is ridiculous because they, for some reason, tell their animators, fully render each scene of every like variation from the storyboard that could go on here, and then we'll go from there, which if you're familiar with the animating process is a ridiculous and expensive way to do things. So instead of having like skeletons of the characters and the way that they're moving and kind of having like a bare bones rendered, they have their artists fully render every scene and do art for everything. And if you've seen either of the Spider-Verse movies, you know how big of an ass that is, because everything, there's like comic book accents and weird sort of like color shifts in the middle of scenes. I'm like, there's no way they're getting this done by next year, and I believe it has been postponed, otherwise it'd be coming out in like a few weeks and we'd be inundated with media push and advertisement. But I thought it was a great movie. Godspeed to the animators that are making the second one. And I think despite its kind of cliffhangery ending, it's still worth it and should win.
I have yet to watch the second Across the Spider-Verse, but the first one, just like watch it for the animation alone.
Yeah,
it is insane. It's going to have you asking questions like, how in the world did they manage to do certain things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the second movie takes that a step above. The villain in it, the Spot, is voiced by Jason Schwartzman, and he is great. He does a great performance, and the Spot as a character is a man covered in like portal holes that he can put places, and like he can travel in between like dimensions and stuff. So that's how he becomes like a multiversal threat. But he's a really interesting villain, and I think Jason Schwartzman does a great job voicing him.
That's cool. I always feel like Jason Schwartzman just plays Jason Schwartzman.
Yeah, and he does in this movie.
He plays himself, basically.
Yeah, yeah, he's pretty much like Gideon from Scott Pilgrim, but with like interdimensional powers. Yeah.
Another category that we really haven't delved into in terms of the movies nominated for it is Best Visual Effects. One of the movies that were nominated is Godzilla Minus One. And Spider-Man and Godzilla definitely are not your typical nominees for anything Oscars, Academy Awards. And I just wanted to talk about Godzilla Minus One a bit because I loved my theater-going experience with this movie. I went in not knowing anything really outside of this big monster movie. Right. but I was blown away. Yes, by the best visuals, which is what it's nominated for, but also by the sound, which is unfortunately is not nominated, which I'm kind of shocked by.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever heard of the 4DX movie experience.
No.
It's like movie theaters that include things outside of the actual movie and like seats that move, artificial snow that rains down on the audience, and like strobe lights. It sounds very gimmicky. Apparently, it's really cool. I haven't been to one myself, but watching Godzilla Minus One in just a standard theater was like the closest I'll probably ever get to experience that. Anytime Godzilla roared, I thought the seats were shaking. Yeah, it was like, I must have just been like the goosebumps or something from it, yeah. I remember hearing that, like, this movie's budget is, like, so low compared to some of the other things, even though that the movie does, like, the CGI magnificently, yeah.
Yeah, the character design and rendering is great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks better than a lot of the other movies on here, despite the fact that it has, like, no budget, yeah, compared to Oppenheimer or Barbie, right. Yeah.
What other movies are listed there? I know Guardians was
Mission Impossible, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. Which honestly is a contender for me too for best visuals. That movie looks really nice. And then a movie called The Creator.
Oh, that is the same director as Rogue One. I really wanted to see that one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I heard it was kind of like visually stunning, but the plot was flat.
Okay.
Which makes sense.
Seems a good category for it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One question I had for everyone was, what's like a category you wish was included, if you could think of one?
I definitely think there should be a best music supervision category because the best original song and best original score categories are fine for what they do. But when I think of the most memorable musical sequences in movies, it's usually a synced song. Like the moments that make me jump out of my seat are when there's a song that I really recognize that fits perfectly in with the action. And this happens on TV shows as well as films. And I think the Emmys should also recognize the music supervisors because I would say like my favorite bit of Barbie, this might be only my favorite bit of Barbie, but the recurring use of the Indigo Girls Closer to Fine made me laugh so hard. And also Push by Matchbox 20 was never a song that I took seriously, but now I never can take it seriously.
Well, that'd be a really hard category for anyone to win in the year that Guardians of the Galaxy comes out. that movie's basically like one big music video.
Yeah.
But
don't they even call the soundtracks mixtapes?
Yeah, yeah. One thing I actually loved a lot about Anatomy of a Fall is that a 50 Cent song was essential to the plot. It was like an instrumental version of one. It's like the very first scene. The husband who dies, you know, like 5 minutes into the movie, he blasts this 50 Cent song to kind of piss off his wife and someone interviewing her.
Okay.
Because he basically like wants these people out of his house. And then the song is used multiple times in like police recreations of the crime scene. All this time while watching this movie, I'm just like, God, I want to know what 50 Cent's opinion on, on this movie was.
Let's see 50 Cent's royalty check first. Yeah, yeah, yeah. If it's more than 50 Cent.
I don't know if he got any royalty from it, because I wonder if he got like a little bit, but it was almost kind of like the MIDI version of it, or like the MIDI.
MIDI.
It felt like something you would hear on like some streaming platform that they were able to use because it didn't have the lyrics because they had kind of recreated in a different way. But yeah, I like that too, where I was like, oh, I recognize that song. And then you just hear it over and over.
I read an article. Apparently that wasn't the original song they wanted to do. They wanted to do Jolene, but they just couldn't get the rights to that one.
Okay. Maybe a little on the nose.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
Or like the song Murder on the Dance Floor by Sophie Ellis Bextor, like raising to the top of the charts after being included in, was it Saltburn?
Saltburn, okay. Yeah. The best ending to a movie from this year for me.
Yeah. I'll leave my thoughts on Saltburn until we get to the snubs. But for categories, I think they should separate true story, biopic, movies, and fiction movies when it comes to best, because I just think it's a very bloated category at this point. You said, what, there are 10 nominations this year? Yeah. And I think, yeah, you could maybe split those like half and half down the middle between fiction and biopic. I don't know. I feel like Maestro is taking up a spot. or one of my snubs that I think should have been recognized, but Iron Claw would have been maybe fared better in a biopic category than it would in an overall Best Picture category. I think you could still keep performance-based categories combined, but as far as deciding Best Picture, they already separate animated and live action. I think you could do that again.
I think we can get into snubs, because I do want to ask you about Iron Claw. Because I think, just reading comments online, that's definitely like the number one pick for a lot of people in terms of like, why was this not included anywhere? Just out of curiosity, why do you think the movie was not included?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it was released late in the cycle. It didn't come out until like December, I don't think. It's maybe a movie that not a whole lot of people went to go see. Maybe Zac Efron isn't taken seriously, although I thought he gave a great performance. But yeah, I'm kind of, I don't know if baffled is too strong of a word, but I'm surprised that it wasn't, I think, adapted screenplay. It could have gotten something there. I think both lead and support for Zac Efron and Jeremy Allen White, they are right up there with some of the other people that are nominated. I thought Zac Efron did a great job. He is really showing that he has the chops to like lead a film. That's probably the closest I've come to crying in a film this year, I would say, just because the story of the Von Erichs is like just so inherently heartbreaking. The main Von Erich, I think it's Kevin Von Erich, you get them all mixed up. They've got very similar sounding names. But the one that Zac Efron plays is just like a very interesting story. Brutal. It's a movie I would recommend to everybody, and it's a movie I would recommend that you only watch once because it is just heartbreaking. The one knock against Zac Efron, I would say, is his accent slips a little bit, but that hasn't hurt Academy nominations for other things in the past, so I don't know why I would do that now. Does anyone else see Iron Claw?
No. I do want to see it, though. I also really do like Zac Efron, so I would like to
see
it.
He's great. He's roided out. He's got a bowl cut. He's got a Texan accent, and he is crying a lot of the time.
Perfect. That's what I want to see.
He's shirtless and crying and sweaty, and yeah, he's great. And I also love Jeremy Allen White. He's in The Bear. He plays Carmy in The Bear. And he's a great actor. He's got those blue eyes. He grew out his real hair, so he's got real long, curly hair in this one. And then the other actors whose names are escaping me that play, because it's a family, if you haven't seen it or aren't familiar with the Von Erichs, it's a family of wrestlers. The father is sort of like a stage father. He was a wrestler in the era before wrestling started getting consolidated into the WWF, which would then become the WWE. So he is doing sort of a Joe Jackson, Michael Jackson's father, bit with his sons, getting them all into wrestling, despite what it's doing to their bodies and their mental health. And it just sort of explores that story. They even omit one of the brothers from the story. I think maybe that's why I wouldn't get a nod for adapted screenplay, because that brother has a very tragic story to him for himself. But it's heartbreaking. It's heavily 80s. The costuming is great. Lily James is the lead woman in it, and she's great. She plays Zac Efron's character's love interest and eventual wife. But yeah, I highly recommend it. Anyone that is interested in wrestling, is a sucker for like biopic movies, you'll enjoy it. Yeah.
I wonder too, because we've had movies that didn't come out till December that still got nominated or still got the buzz that got them nominated. The Color Purple might be another one that I'm surprised didn't get up there. I agree about the biopic having its own category. Or I was talking to someone, they say a lot of times biopics will be up there for Oscars because it's something that someone can kind of cling to, where like in the same way that we like comic book movies or like superhero movies where we recognize that content and it's something that we already feel familiar and attached to, biopics give us that too, where I think every year you'll see at least one biopic.
I think they keep getting made because they're such reliable Oscar bait.
And I think that's the thing where if you're looking at still the familiar, oftentimes those Marvel movies aren't Oscar bait. But then if you were to equate it with something like a biopic, that is so easy to say, oh, I want this on there.
Yeah. And I think just the way that the voting process works, everyone who's on, like, a part of the Academy, they're given, you know, like the 200-plus movies that are valid for nominations. And if it's something they're already probably familiar with, like a biography, they'll probably be more likely to watch it, yeah, so.
I wonder if there should be a category for best popular box office hits on there, because I just think that would be nice to – I don't know if it needs it necessarily, but Barbie could have won that one.
Oh, Barbie would definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Or even, you know what I mean?
Best blockbuster.
Because I think there's a lot of people who say like, oh, I don't really watch the Oscar movies. And Oscar movies, sometimes there is a little bit of gatekeeping, I think, in them. And I think that would open it up a little bit more and maybe bring in a different kind of audience that – they've been wanting to dive into it. And like, they want younger people, and that's something that they're worried about. And these films aren't necessarily accomplishing that. That's not a complaint, really, because I loved these films this year. But for the future of it, if they're wondering what it's going to look like, that could be something that they could add.
Yeah.
I wonder how much of it is popularity versus, like, as far as the Oscars for what gets on there. But there is a horror film called When Evil Lurks, and that's a Spanish film that came out this year, and I thought it was fantastic. I really liked it. I thought it was well acted.
I have to say, horror is always snubbed, I feel.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would really include it. Also, I think it might have been too late. Talk to Me, if you saw that one.
Oh, I did see that one.
Yeah. I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I did like it. I don't know if I would include it.
Probably best editing. It has some pretty good
transitions. That was really good, yeah. Yeah, I think horror is a hard one because I think a lot of people don't like it, and it's hard. Like, that's one. I have one friend who will watch horror films with me, and I'm too scared to watch it alone. So it's one of those things that I think people just don't watch that often.
I wouldn't really call this movie a horror film, but Beau is Afraid, I think, may have been snubbed for cinematography. Would probably be the only category I would include that in. But that's a really interesting movie. Did anyone else see that one?
No.
That is, it's Ari Aster, so that's why it's considered horror, because he did Midsommar and Hereditary. But I would call it more of like a psychological, not even thriller, just psychological trauma. Joaquin Phoenix is a man in his 40s who has a bad codependent relationship with his mother, is suffering from a lot of mental health issues. His mother dies, and it's about his, like, Odyssey-like journey to his mother's funeral. There's a lot of, like, magical realism and surrealist things going on. The film, you get the sense that it's, like, through his perspective, and he is kind of coded to be either be suffering from schizophrenia, maybe, like, bipolar disorder. That kind of colors the world around him. And it's a very interesting and weird movie. It's 3 hours. I went to go see it by myself in the theater, and I was like, yeah, don't go see that in the theater.
I want to mention, that's also on Canopy.
That is.
I just wanted to ask, it's kind of the final question, like, are you actually going to watch the Oscars live? Like, does everyone do that usually?
No.
I found if you're on social media while any award ceremony is happening, you find out about things soon enough. Yeah. Like, I didn't watch The Slap. You can hear the capitalization.
Yeah. Oh,
the
I slap. Did.
I didn't watch it live, but I knew within about 5 minutes that it had happened.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
What a strange cultural touchstone this the Will Smith slap is.
I do watch them. I like them. I usually have friends who have Oscar parties. This year, I'm actually going to be out of town for it. And my boyfriend doesn't know that we're going to go to a bar and watch it. I haven't told him yet, but
you'll
that's what we're going to do.
Podcast.
Yeah, so I will probably try to watch it live some way or another.
I'm kind of in the same camp as Charlie. I don't really pay super close attention to the Oscars. When are the Oscars?
March 10th.
March 10th, Sunday.
Yeah. Okay. You know, if it's on, it's on. Like, I went out to dinner when the Grammys were happening, and the Grammys happened, and I saw Tracy Chapman play Fast Car. And that was good. Yeah. I enjoyed that. But the Academy Awards, for me, at this point, kind of feel like Hollywood handing themselves. Like, it's that meme of Obama putting a medal on his own neck, if you have ever seen that.
Oh, yeah.
It's just kind of like, we all know the people involved in making these films, because we're all, everyone voting is an industry professional. To an extent, it's a popularity contest. I didn't see Maestro, but that's kind of the vibe I get from all the nominations that I got, because it did kind of seem like a Bradley Cooper vanity project.
That's how I felt about A Star Is Born, too.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just the Bradley Cooper
He might just be
vibe.
A charismatic guy.
Know.
Yeah, everybody's friend.
I don't know. That being said, I loved Silver Linings Playbook and also listened to that song from A Star Is Born like at least 20 times.
I just wanted to say that I used to, like, never care about the Oscars. I mean, I still don't care, but I do watch it for the podcast, but I also have a group of friends that do kind of watch it almost as the Super Bowl, where they make the whole, like, betting sheet, and then they even, like, buy prizes. So for that alone, I mean, it's
we do that, too. Yeah. I think part of it is – I agree. I think it is a lot of patting ourselves on the back for how good and how insular we still are.
Yeah.
But – that being said, my friends and I treat these award ceremonies as a reason to get together and usually like have some themed food. And we do answer sheets on who we think is going to win and bet. And there has been some yelling and contention before, which I look forward to.
we all wear jerseys.
Yeah.
Favorite director. And then, of course, there's a whole like – the lead up to the Oscars, I would not watch so many of these movies if not for the fact that you had this cultural event. Yeah, mm-hmm. So
I think that's a fair point.
Yeah,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If they got rid of it, would these films be as watched as they are? Probably not.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, the people who are into it are people who are into it. Like there's the International Film Festival where my dad and his girlfriend saw Zone of Interest, and I know we have a coworker here who that's how he wanted to see. Boy and the Heron.
Hmm. I mean, I wouldn't have heard of American Fiction had I not sat down at this table, so I'm,
watch
I'm next on my list. Yeah. I will say, probably the bit of the Oscars broadcast that I'm most excited to watch the day after on YouTube or wherever it ends up are the musical performances.
Oh, those are always good.
Because I think my favorite category is the best original song because it's always so all over the place. And, like, this year, there's a choice from Killers of the Flower Moon that's, like, an indigenous traditional song sung by, like, the Osage tribal singers. And then there's a nomination from the film Flamin' Hot, which
that's
is
wild.
An inspirational reggaeton song about Cheetos written by Diane Warren, who has been nominated 15 times for Best Original Song and never won.
Oh.
And if Diane Warren wins for The Fire Inside, but not for How Will I Live or I Don't Want to Miss a Thing, that'll say more about the weird choices the Oscars voters make than anything else.
But I think that can also bring you back to kind of American Fiction in a lot of ways, too, where they're saying, like, what makes this not as high up as some of her other original songs that she had created? Have you listened to all those songs, Charlie?
All the Diane Warren songs?
Well, not all of Diane. all the Oscar-nominated songs.
Yes, yeah. I did make a point of listening to all of them. And
do you have a pick for a winner?
I do. I think the Billie Eilish ones should win, although I say that guarded because the reason I like Billie Eilish is because she's such a daring figure. Like, her solo albums are always very adventurous from a sonic standpoint, but all the things that she ever gets nominated for are, like, her James Bond theme, which was a little middle of the road, and What Was I Made For, which is a lovely song, and it's I can't wait to see how they present it for the performance, but it's a little bit torch ballad, and I think she sang, like, Yesterday for the In Memoriam a couple years back, so it's like she's in danger of being pigeonholed as, like, the big ballad singer, and she's so much weirder, and her brother Phineas, they're weirdos, they're proper pop weirdos.
She's been leaning into those ballads, though.
Yeah.
I love the song that she's nominated for, and I do think that'll win, too. But she's been, even Happier Than Ever, like her most recent album, she's been leaning into those ballads, and I love them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I hope she's not pigeonholed, because she does some interesting stuff, even, like, her music videos and stuff, but I always think it's either ballad or whisper song.
Right.
So I don't know which way she's being pigeonholed.
I want to say you got me really excited for the musical performance because I forgot last year was RRR, which they did the suspender dance, which is like awesome. Yeah,
great movie. I didn't know they did that at the Oscars.
Yeah.
And I hear Ryan Gosling is going to perform I'm Just Ken.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
he was great. I love him in that movie. Yeah,
he was very good. I don't know if I think it's Oscar nominee worthy. But
no.
But it'll be fun. It'll be fun television.
Yeah.
I heard like he asked to like just get some royalties from just that song, but that's been the most popular song of the movie. So he's gotten a ton of money from it, I think.
The man song from the feminist
movie.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Right.
All right, well, I wanted to thank everyone for coming. The Oscars is March 10th, and a lot of these that we talked about, outside of Killers at the moment, which I'm sure will get a physical release, are all available at the library, and a lot of these are available through, like, Canopy.